Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
T-Mobile is more than the best network in the game. They're now the best network in America, according to the experts at Ookla Speedtest. So baseball fans are connected to the Fall Classic from home to home plate with the most advanced 5G. More towers and a signal that goes farther than ever before. T-Mobile has you covered. For baseball fans, it's better over here.
Best mobile network based on analysis by Ookla of Speedtest Intelligence data, first half 2025. See details at T-Mobile.com.
SoCal's Country Station, 95.1 K-Frog. I'm Pepper. This is Spirit of the IE. This morning, we're diving into a subject that's fascinated and sometimes misled the public for decades, criminal profiling. From Jack the Ripper to the Unabomber, profilers have been portrayed as brilliant detectives who can read a killer's mind. But how much of that is real and how much is myth? Award-winning author and journalist Rachel Corbett explores that question in her new book, The Monsters We Make, Murder, Obsession, and the Rise of Criminal Profiling. Drawing from history, psychology, and her own personal connection to an act of violence, Corbett traces profiling's origins in Victorian England to its modern-day digital form and reveals what it tells us and what it hides about human behavior. Rachel's on the line to tell us about the roots of profiling, its evolution through the FBI era, and what happens when science, storytelling, and our desire for control collide. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
First off, congratulations on the new book. For those who haven't heard about The Monsters We Make yet, what inspired you to take on the topic of criminal profiling?
Well, originally, I was thinking about it as a consumer of true crime media. I'm one of those people who watches all of Law and Order, every episode pretty much. And I love the crime shows. And when I was younger, I got really into books like In Cold Blood, The Executioner's Song, these long narrative nonfiction accounts of murders. But, you know, I also have a personal connection, as you mentioned. When I was a child, my mother's former partner of a few years ended up killing his next girlfriend, the woman he dated right after my mother. And then he killed himself. And this was, you know, shocking enough at the time, but I wasn't told about the murder part of it until I was older. And it was just unthinkable when I learned that this guy who had always been so gentle seeming, totally nonviolent, you know, just quiet, nice guy, had done something so horrific. And I looked into the case and I tried to kind of put it together. Like, I already knew who the murderer was, of course, but I didn't understand who he was because this wasn't the guy I knew. So I kind of was trying to solve it from that perspective. And I talked to sociologists, I talked to the police who found the bodies, I, you know, talked to forensic psychiatrists, and I really tried to put it back together. And I ended up with a kind of profile of this guy, Scott was his name. And I had done it like a journalist would. I'm a journalist, but I didn't feel like I knew anymore. It didn't feel like there was an emotional truth to what I'd found. And I think this is something, you know, obviously it's personal for me, but I think this is something that is, you know, very almost universal, this desire to understand the people who terrify us the most. So I think that's why, you know, we get so into these kinds of shows, like I was mentioning. But the problem is, are we really learning about this stuff? Are we really getting closer to the truth, or are we actually farther from it? Because, you know, we think we understand something, we actually don't.
How did that personal connection shape the way you approached this research?
When I first was doing this research about Scott, I was in my early 20s and I was approaching it like kind of an investigator. And, you know, now it's been quite a few years since then. And I think I look back on my own attempt to resolve that as a kind of fallacy. a kind of attempt to write the narrative of his life as it intersected with mine. And I think the way that we narrativize crime is a big part of how we understand crime. But it's often very subjective, and it's sometimes more fictional than it is fact. And so when I look into the history of profiling, that's exactly what I found, was this kind of these attempts to control narratives, you know, intentionally or unintentionally. And as consumers of this media, you know, desire to read about it in a story with an arc, you know, a beginning, middle, end. We catch the perpetrator in the end, you know, and we know why it all happened. But as I was writing this book, I realized that what I longed for in my own life, you know, what I wanted to do with Scott to understand is what we all do. So that informed the book and how I thought about, you know, the relationship of fiction and true crime, and that they're a little bit closer than you might think.
You trace the origins of profiling back to Victorian England and even to the Jack the Ripper case. What were those early efforts like, and how much of them were rooted in science versus storytelling?
Well, back then we didn't have a lot of science. So, you know, there was no fingerprints. There was, you know, no DNA, of course. The Scotland Yard was relatively new in itself. So they based a lot on hunches and eyewitness observations. And it was really hard to solve crimes then compared to now. So one of the interesting things about the Jack the Ripper case is that Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes, was actually brought in by one of the former, I think he was a police surgeon, to help try to solve the case. And of course, Doyle was not a detective. He was a fiction writer. But people conflated the two all the time. And so he tried to get into Sherlock Holmes's mind and put on that cap and think, you know, from his point of view. And he wrote kind of a little sketch of what he thought the perpetrator might be. And it was also at the same time that another surgeon or a forensic specialist by the name of Thomas Bond also wrote what is kind of considered the first modern criminal profile, in which he, because Jack the Ripper had stumped people for years, the police had no leads, and all these women had been murdered and it had gone on for years without resolution. He tried to get creative with how to solve it. And he started thinking, well, what do the victims tell us about him? Let's think about the way he killed them. What might have been going on in his mind, and how might he have dressed, or what might his mannerisms be like to be someone who could carry out these crimes in public? That sort of thing. So then we start getting into, you know, the psychology of the killer more than just the facts of, you know, the scene.
You write about how early criminologists tried to read criminality and physical traits like phrenology, physiognomy, even skull measurements. Why did these ideas take hold, and how do echoes of them still show up in modern thinking?
In the Industrial Revolution started taking place across Europe, there were these big influxes of immigration. So in London at the time, you had people coming from Eastern Europe. A lot of Jewish people were coming in. You also had people from, you know, rural areas coming. And it created this kind of fear. There was all these different looking faces and different accents, and in Victorian England at the time. So, you know, you start getting phrenology and these different ideas about that you can look at someone's face or the shape of their head and determine who's going to be a criminal among them. I think it helped kind of satiate this fear of the other at this time. And so, you know, of course, we know that's not true. It's not possible. It lasted for, you know, 100 or more years, you know, and this happened also. So in Italy, a guy called Cesare Lombroso, who's considered the kind of godfather of criminology, was doing the same thing. He wrote a book called Criminal Man. And he decided that, you know, you could look at who would be a criminal based on the, like, you know, the shape of their nose or the line of their jaw. And it turned out that the people he decided were criminals were those who were most different from him. Asian faces, black faces from Africa, or he was a Northern Italian, so he thought Southern Italians were more likely to be criminals. This persisted for years, up until basically World War II, when the idea that you could persecute entire classes of people became so horrific that we stopped judging people by their physical characteristics in law enforcement or in the court. And, you know, now it still happens, but it happens in a more subtle way.
I'm speaking with Rachel Corbett, author of The Monsters We Make, Murder, Obsession, and the Rise of Criminal Profiling. You describe in your book how profiling evolved from literary imagination to criminology and then into a serious investigative tool. What were the turning points that gave profiling its scientific credibility, or at least the appearance of it?
One of the biggest turning points in the history of profiling was actually Ted Bundy, when he was crossing the country, murdering women, especially college women on campuses in the 70s, the FBI was starting to take note of this type of criminal who was crossing state lines, which when you cross state lines, it becomes the jurisdiction of the FBI rather than just state police. And the FBI did a kind of smart thing, which is that, you know, they kind of drummed up this idea of a really serious serial killer epidemic in the 1980s. You had John Wayne Gacy, a number of others at the time. And they said, you know, we have the solution to this epidemic, which they exaggerated the epidemic, of course. They said that 4,000 or 5,000 people were dying by serial murder every year, when in reality it was more like 400 or 500. But it gave them the opportunity to say, we have these elite profilers here in the newly formed behavioral science unit, and they study research, they know the criminal mind, and they can get into their heads and solve crimes no one else can. So Ted Bundy really put the profilers on the map. They said, you know, if we had these kinds of tools before, we could have stopped Bundy. So that's how it really entered the public consciousness.
Some of the figures you profile, like Ted Bundy, who you've been talking about, the Unabomber, and Jeffrey Dahmer, have become almost mythic in true crime culture. How did profiling shape public fascination with these cases?
With Ted Bundy especially, the FBI had their profilers out talking to the press all the time, you know, giving interviews and saying, you know, we've got these special tools to catch these guys. The problem is that while it became really popular, it wasn't really helping them solve the crimes. And it did help them get congressional funding. It helped them expand their jurisdiction and overall gain more control. But it didn't really solve the problem. So I think we know a lot more about Ted Bundy today than we ever would have. The FBI not kind of been drumming up all this fear and this idea of the serial killer epidemic. So I think that, you know, the idea of these big celebrity serial killers really came out in this time. Yeah, like you mentioned, Dahmer, Gacy, all of these guys. I think that this idea of the kind of celebrity serial killer comes out of that sort of press circus around the FBI.
You also delve into how the FBI's behavioral science unit came to define profiling as we know it. What role did early profilers play in shaping its methods and myths?
Well, you know, John Douglas, who's one of the most famous FBI profilers, he wrote the book Mindhunter, that the TV show was based on. He said that the earliest antecedents of his profession was crime fiction rather than crime fact. And he said that specifically, Sherlock Holmes was someone that he considered a model. He'd read all the books. And I think that really goes to show just how much things hadn't changed since the days when, you know, in Victorian England, when the London police were turning to Sherlock Holmes also to solve these crimes. You know, there was just this interest in creating narratives around these people's lives, I mean, these murderers' lives and minds. And that persists, you know, and even today, when we have much more sophisticated tools to profile people, such as data-driven policing and predictive policing and algorithms and all of that, we end up targeting a very similar set of people than as we did back in the days of phrenology.
You mentioned that shows like Mindhunter and Criminal Minds and countless documentaries have turned profilers into pop culture heroes. What do these portrayals get right, and what do they get completely wrong?
Unfortunately, I think they get more wrong than they get right. There's a study in England that found that only about 2.7% of criminal profiles led to the capture of the suspect, even though police generally thought they were very useful. So I think when they're effective, it's just kind of one very small minor tool you would have in your sort of investigator's toolkit, because, you know, maybe it helps in certain cases when you just really have no other clues and you need to narrow down the field somehow. Like, you know, the Unabomber, for example, was thought, well, this is probably going to be a white guy, because every other sort of American bomber had been to that point. And, you know, it might be an educated guy, which wasn't hard to deduce. So, you know, maybe it's kind of, you know, when, in a situation like that, you had a needle in the haystack. Ted Kaczynski didn't leave a shred of physical evidence on anything, any of his bombs. So they were really at a complete loss for years, much like, you know, with Jack the Ripper. And so I think, you know, thinking a little more creatively about what kind of person this might be helped in that case. And in fact, ultimately, although it was Ted's brother, David, who turned him in order to get the warrant, an FBI profiler by the name of James Fitzgerald did something that he kind of, a field he kind of pioneered called linguistic profiling. And he looked at letters and old writings of Ted Kaczynski's that David, his brother, had supplied, and he compared them to the manifesto. And what he found there was enough similarity, turns of phrases, sort of regionalisms, that he could convince a judge to give them an arrest warrant, to go to the cabin and arrest Kaczynski. So there are different forms of profiling that I think, you know, are more effective and that can be used in very interesting ways to build cases.
In your research, how effective did you find profiling to be in solving actual crimes? Is there evidence that it really works, or is it more of a psychological comfort to the public and law enforcement?
Yeah, I think unfortunately it's really a psychological comfort. It's a really seductive idea. I think not only do we want to understand the minds of the killers and look at these experts and kind of watch how they do it, and I think we believe maybe we can do it ourselves. Maybe we'll be safer. Maybe we'll be smarter if something horrible ever happens to us. But unfortunately, it just hasn't stood up to the evidence. And a lot of times they're not really doing it as much anymore in the same way. Some of the research that the sort of original class of FBI profilers found has kind of been debunked by psychiatrists later on, like the idea of there are organized criminals and disorganized criminals. These are the kind of typologies and classifications that they were trying to make based on interviews they did with serial killers. But there's a lot of other factors involved. There's, you know, biology, neurology, psychology, family history, genetics, all these other factors that can go into the making of a murderer that, you know, I think to tell that story would probably be too complicated for a 42-minute TV episode. But the idea of understanding the mind is certainly a seductive idea.
Why do you think we as a culture want profiling to work so badly, even when the data shows that it often doesn't?
I think it gives us comfort and a sense of control over our own lives. And, you know, by kind of turning these horrible concepts into something more manageable, something solvable, then, you know, we can deal with it better. I know from my own perspective, I think that trying to understand the story of Scott was a way to take control of the things that had rendered me really helpless as a child. And there's nothing worse than that feeling, you know, when you're a victim of a crime, you're at your most helpless. And there's something, a defense, I think, that kicks in that we just can't tolerate that feeling. And, you know, I think that's also why women tend to be the biggest consumers of true crime media. Every woman can identify with the fear of being a victim. And so I think that there's a reason why women are drawn to it more. The men hopefully don't have a male figure in the stories to identify with as much, you know, unless it's a serial killer. So I think it is doing something for us psychologically.
I'm speaking with Rachel Corbett, author of the new book, The Monsters We Make, Murder, Obsession, and the Rise of Criminal Profiling. In this book, you explore how trauma, environment, and childhood experiences can shape violent behavior. What did you learn about the real roots of violence that profiling tends to overlook?
One of the stories I tell in the book is about a Yale psychiatrist named Dorothy Lewis, who spent her whole long career trying to understand exactly this question of what is the origins of violence, what makes someone violent. And she took a really multi-pronged approach. She herself was a psychiatrist, but she worked with a neurologist, and they started looking for biological bases. And what they ultimately found was that there's sort of three factors that are important into someone becoming violent, and it is a combination of usually childhood abuse or trauma of some kind. Another factor can be like a brain injury. So if you got hit on the head when you're young, you know, maybe from the abuse, who knows, it might impair a part of your brain that, say, controls impulse regulation or certain like emotional regulations. And so that's another component that will make you more likely to act on the anger you might already feel. And then the third is often a paranoia, or it could be or psychosis or some kind of mental disorder that would create a heightened awareness. Someone who's paranoid might think they're being slighted even when they're not. So it's really a combination of many factors, and there may even be other ones. There are people who are looking into whether or not there are genes at play in violence, but certainly it's not one thing. Certainly it's a combination of all of these things. We know that much. It's a fascinating question that I think lots of people are still trying to understand.
Profiling promises control, the idea that if we can identify patterns, we can prevent evil. But your book suggests that violence often resists tidy explanations. So how do we reconcile that tension?
Yeah, I think that tension is what we're trying to avoid so much when we, you know, watch these profiling shows and CSI and all of this. That tension is something that just we can't stand, this idea of not knowing. But, you know, if you think about it, it actually creates kind of this even greater ignorance in thinking that you're making this unknown concept of evil known. But actually, you don't really understand it. It's just kind of you just kind of feel like you understand it, or you get the feeling of knowledge by watching a show about profiling, say. You're actually thwarting any possibility of understanding the real truth. So it's in avoiding this dissonance, like you were describing, this tension, I think it takes us much further from the truth, and it takes us further from the situations that might be actually more threatening to us. You know, while we're busy looking at somebody over here worrying about a serial killer, we may not be thinking about what the real dangers are in our lives, or, you know, even worse, like whether the institutions of the people pointing the finger over there are actually the ones you might fear. I mean, this is a little convoluted, but I mean, sometimes in the FBI's case, you know, I think that they had their own interest in creating profiles of serial killers, you know, for their own benefit. And in the case of a sheriff's department that I look at in the book in Florida, it was actually the sheriffs who I would argue were greater criminals than the people they were trying to point the finger at.
A lot of profiling today has evolved into algorithmic or predictive policing, using data and AI to forecast crime. How is that different from traditional profiling, and what new dangers does it pose?
Predictive policing, as was the term up until, you know, the last 10 years or 15 years or so, uses data to create profiles. So it could take someone's past police records, it could take information about where they live, the geographical patterns of crime in their area. It could look at social media, who their friends are, if they are, you know, associating with any gang members or suspected gang members, for example. And it takes all of this and it creates a profile of who might commit a crime and who to target. You know, and today, sometimes there are algorithms that can do this now. Sometimes there's AI, there's facial recognition technology. There's all these ways we profile people today. The idea is that it's a cutting edge sort of technology. It's science. So therefore, it'll be more objective. And, you know, there may be some truth to that. But the problem is that, you know, throughout history, we've seen scientific advancements, like phrenology was seen as an, you know, incredible scientific advance that ended up still perpetuating the same old biases. And we're seeing that with data-driven policing, too, because sometimes they're using data that comes from, say, old arrest records. You know, and now we know that the way police arrested people 20, 40, 60 years ago is not the way we would accept now. You know, some of the practices are such as stop and frisk are now considered unconstitutional, but that information is still being fed into the algorithm. And so you're getting still biased targeting of the people. So, you know, we have to be very careful of what we consider science and objectivity in these sorts of things.
So what are the ethical implications of relying on digital profiling tools in modern law enforcement?
Well, I think a lot of police departments now have gotten rid of predictive policing, at least in the form it was. What's worrisome is that we don't really know a lot of what these algorithms are that, say, police departments or the government are using today. There's huge contracts. You know, we know that ICE has pretty sophisticated tools, for example. So does the CIA, obviously. I imagine, you know, many police forces in, you know, LA and New York that are using all kinds of data still. Facial recognition is hugely popular, even though can't quite determine black faces with the same precision that it can lighter skinned faces. So I think the fear is there should be more transparency around what data is going into these models and where it's coming from, and making sure that, you know, there's no privacy violations or possible violations of civil rights and that kind of thing.
Do you see any responsible way forward for behavioral or predictive analysis in policing, or do we need to rethink that entire concept?
Well, I think there's a lot of benefit of thinking about the psychology and the backgrounds of criminals. I wish that there was more overlap between the detectives and the police work and the medical field and the psychiatric community, because everyone wants the same thing. You know, everyone wants people to be safe. But the questions of, you know, it's a kind of age old sort of culture war in this country where, you know, they've got people saying we need to it's evil, we need to lock them up, it's black and white. You know, and then you've got people saying, well, yes, you know, we need to protect people from these people. But maybe we need to get them mental health treatments, all of that, you know, that kind of back and forth. And I wish there was a way to make it less of a conflict and more of a working in tandem for the same goals, because certainly psychiatrists and other neurologists have made advancements in understanding this behavior. I think we just need to work together and also, you know, think about these new technologies now that big tech has become so involved in these questions.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile is more than the best network in the game. They're now the best network in America, according to the experts at Ookla Speedtest. So baseball fans are connected to the Fall Classic from home to home plate with the most advanced 5G. More towers and a signal that goes farther than ever before. T-Mobile has you covered. For baseball fans, it's better over here.
Best mobile network based on analysis by Ookla of Speedtest Intelligence data, first half 2025. See details at T-Mobile.com.
You know, we really need more insight into what they're doing and find ways to make it safe.
I'm speaking with Rachel Corbett, author of the new book, The Monsters We Make, Murder, Obsession, and the Rise of Criminal Profiling. This title, The Monsters We Make, suggests that society plays a role in creating the very people it fears. What do you mean by that?
I think that every profile says as much about the person who's writing it or creating it as it does about the person they're trying to profile. It's always, you know, in the history of art, a profile is a side view of a face. And I think that's a very apt way of thinking about profiling because you're seeing just part of the face. You're seeing the part that the viewer sees. So I think about, you know, the profiler as someone whose his prediction is always going to be informed by his pre-existing expectation, what he already thinks, what's happened to him in the past, what he's seen, you know, maybe through experience in police work or maybe through, you know, a million other factors in that person's life are going to shape who he suspects and, you know, what gets written down as evidence and what doesn't. So I think that, you know, I'm not implying that there aren't monsters that are coming at this already, but that are, you know, already made. But we do play a role in shaping the stories of monstrosity, of who becomes a monster, who doesn't. Why do certain people get villainized in certain times and places? There are social factors that make those monsters. So I guess I'm thinking about it as a kind of two-way street, looking at both the profilers and the people who are profiled and the kind of way that they create something together.
After spending years immersed in this dark and complicated subject, what surprised you most, or was there anything that changed your view of justice, crime, or human nature?
I have to say that going into this book, I was really thinking I wanted to just understand criminal profiling from the point of view of a student. I just wanted to know more about it. It fascinated me. And I thought, you know, I would just learn how it's done. And so I think the whole premise of the book is something that shifted entirely while I was writing it. And I didn't realize how much history had repeated itself over and over again, and always through the guise of progress and science and technology. And that was very surprising to me. And just the way there's so many repetitions in the book. The other thing I thought was very surprising was Ted Kaczynski's backstory. You know, he was a prodigy at Harvard when he was just 16. And he met there a psychologist, the head of the Harvard Psychology Clinic, Henry Murray, who himself had profiled Hitler for the CIA. So he knew something about psychological profiling already. And he conducted this series of very cruel and unethical experiments on his students, including Kaczynski. And as you go on, you know, I think, again, there's many things that turned Kaczynski into a monster. But I find it hard to believe that this didn't play some role in it. So just this repetition again and again of how criminals get created, the abuse or the backstories that lead into their criminality are these all these repetitions, the past coming back to the present. And I felt that both in the history of profiling and in the individual cases.
How do you balance empathy and accountability when writing about people who have committed horrific acts?
You know, I think that these people who commit murder or other horrific crimes need to be put away from society. I believe that there's no way to be safe without that. But what we do with them after that point has been the subject of such intense debate. You know, the death penalty has come in and out of fashion or sort of political sway, you know, back and forth over the years. Reagan was elected, you know, governor in California largely on the basis of his very strong pro-death penalty views. You know, personally, I think that that doesn't really helped in making us safer, which would be my only, I'm personally someone who doesn't feel that a punitive or revengeful act is going to help victims. But, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said for thinking about treatment. You know, in this country, we don't fund psychiatric hospitals in the same way or psychiatric prisons and places where they can try to rehabilitate people or at least make some improvements. I don't think that, you know, Ted Bundy is going to be rehabilitated ever and sent back out into the public. That's not something that I think is possible. But I would be open to thinking more about ways to keep people safe, keep these people off the streets, and also what can we learn from them? You know, if you execute somebody, you can't learn from them anymore. And maybe at least we could try to understand how this happens better.
What do you hope readers and maybe even law enforcement professionals will take away from this book?
I hope that we just think about our own fallibility and our own, the ways that our lives shape the way we view the world, which is a very simple thing to say. But I would like people to maybe reflect more when they're watching these shows, when they're thinking about crimes. You know, what is it that they're getting out of it? What are they afraid of? You know, what are the things that this is doing for them? And, you know, in law enforcement, you know, I think that a lot of police departments are eager for better new tools, and that is completely understandable. But just because something is new, you know, it needs to be critically examined, and that for every possible harm as well as every possible advantage.
I've been speaking with Rachel Corbett, author of The Monsters We Make, Murder, Obsession, and the Rise of Criminal Profiling. How would you like us to get your book, and how can we learn more about your work?
Well, you can get the book at any local bookstore or Amazon, of course. And I'm a journalist here in New York, so I work for also New York Magazine. I write features there. So that's where you can find a lot of my work. And at my website, rachel-corbett.com, you can find me there. You can find me on social media at Rachel N. Corbett. And yeah, I'm around.
And that's Corbett with a C, one B, and two T's.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, and have a happy and safe Halloween.
Thanks. You too. It was a pleasure.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5.
I know where I'm going to bet from now on.
Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
T-Mobile is more than the best network in the game. They're now the best network in America, according to the experts at Ookla Speed Test. So baseball fans are connected to the fall classic from home to home plate with the most advanced 5G. More towers and a signal that goes farther than ever before. T-Mobile has you covered. For baseball fans, it's better over here.
Best mobile network based on analysis by Ookla of speed test intelligence data, first half 2025. See details at T-Mobile.com.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Get smoother, brighter skin instantly in one easy step. Dermalogica's Daily Microfoliant gives you the smooth, glowy skin you want without damaging your skin barrier. This gentle exfoliating powder activates with water to smooth out rough texture and brighten skin. It's powerful enough to deliver results, yet gentle enough to use every single day, even on sensitive skin. See the results for yourself. Visit Dermalogica.com and use code SMOOTH at cart for an exclusive free gift with $65 purchase.